Thank you. I'm very much enjoying this conference as it's trying to generate new ideas to try to get around decoherence effects, which of course is a very important topic for quantum computing. And what I want to talk today about is looking at this problem from a little bit more practical point of view, kind of taking, you know, the experimental systems we have now and looking at decoherence, in this case, from a particular mechanism. And I kind of want to introduce the subject by asking a very simple question. And, you know, given these implementations and others, what physics is practically limiting our coherence? And I kind of take a maybe a little bit unusual point of view, but I think there's a chance that this is correct, in that if we could just write down the Hamiltonians of the basic physics of this, including, let's say, electromagnetic radiation, which would give you decoherence effects, and if that's all the physics that was describing these systems, we could basically make a lot of progress building a quantum computer and probably just build it. And maybe all these systems, okay? The basic physics and Hamiltonians of these systems really allow you to make something. But in reality, things are a little bit harder, and things are maybe won't work for some or all of these systems. And that's because there's some physics in here that are not normally known or talked about, or kind of it's ugly so you don't talk about it, that limits the decoherence. And I call this dirt physics, and given that this is KITP, I'll write this as Hamiltonian of dirt. And this is the problem in these various systems. Now, of course, this is very general, and I can say that, and it's probably true. But what I want to talk about in the initial couple slides is I think at this point, knowing a little bit about the physics of these systems and what goes wrong, we may have a guess as what is the major component of H-dirt that gives us problems in trying to make a quantum computer. And, you know, if we start understanding what's going on, well, then we can start trying to fix it and make things better. And that's kind of the story of what I'm going to be talking about, is once we understand what H-dirt is, how to go about fixing it. So to introduce what H-dirt is, let's just talk about particular implementations. So let's look at the Josephson, which is what we're doing. And basically in the Josephson junction, how you kind of design the circuit is basically limited by, it turns out, noise in your parameters of your device, says, such as charge, critical current, or flux. Okay, and what happens is these experimental parameters, you think you're fixing, but they're varying in time due to some unknown dirt physics. Typically, they vary according to 1 over F noise, which means that they vary at bigger amplitudes at lower frequencies. Okay? And we see both low frequency and high frequency effects of these, and knowing the physics of this, these are basically coming what we call two-level states. There are fluctuators in the system, fluctuating this charge or critical current up and down with time, and giving you this 1 over F noise. And there are ways of going to get around it and the like, but it's just a practical limitation. And like I say, probably one of the major limitations of giving this technology to work. So let me talk a little bit outside my field, but I think what I'm going to say here is correct. Let's take the recent results from Harvard. We have these beautiful semiconductor spin results. What's limiting the performance of that system? That's the nuclear spin noise in the gallium arsenide, because these have nuclear moments. Well, why don't we just fix that system by making it out of silicon in some isotope that doesn't have a nuclear spin? Why don't we do that? Because silicon has a lot more charged noise than gallium arsenide. Okay? And in fact, the gallium arsenide has low 1 over F noise, but even if it's low, you still have to encode it in the singlet triplet states to get rid of the 1 over F charge noise. And if you try to do this in silicon, it's going to be a disaster, so you don't do it. So if we could get rid of 1 over F charge noise here, 1 over F charge noise here, hey, this would be great. Both of these systems would be great. So let's now talk about ion traps, which I know a little bit about because when I was at NIST, Dave Wineland was down the hall. And at the time I was there, they were talking about patch potential problems in their ion traps. So they moved their ion trap to some interaction regime, and for some of their sort of earlier devices, they would have electric field fluctuations in that trap that would move the ions around when you were interacting and then give you some kind of decoherence during the couple gates a part of it. Now, it's nice because as they've been able to improve theirs, they've been able to get rid of patch potentials to some degree through carefully shielding of the leads. But what I want to point out here is as we go and start trying to build integrated circuits for ion traps, it's likely that the materials you're going to use to build these ion traps are going to have these patch potential problems, and you're going to have to fight hard to get rid of it and figure out how to deal with it. So this patch potentials, there's a fluctuating electric field. It's kind of like this 1 over F noise of charged two-level systems. Probably something you're going to have to deal with. So I hope you see that there's a kind of a problem here of 1 over F noise from two-level systems, specifically charge noise, that seems to be a limitation of these quantum computing devices. So in fact, what I'm motivating here, I'm not proving it, but I'm motivating, is that this dirt physics we have to deal with is understanding two-level state physics and specifically charge fluctuations. So that's essentially what I really want to highlight in this talk, is try to get people to start thinking about this. So what I want to do is talk about first in this talk, I'm going to chat a little bit about the interesting physics of this. Because the two-level states, actually there's very fascinating physics that come out of it. And let me just review that here. Normally you have a qubit separated by some frequency here, and you normally think of decoherence by coupling it to some bath of other states. And typically that's a bosonic bath, spin boson model. This is a linear system, equally spaced states. When you do that, you get kind of a very simple prediction of the decoherence. Coherence decays exponentially in time for T1 effects, which is a decay from here to here that's basically due to the dissipation of this bosonic bath, which is proportional to the number of states in the coupling at this oscillation frequency. So energy here goes into here. Or noise in this system, so that energy in here flows back into here, causing transitions here. So that's the density of states at this transition frequency. Also, it turns out that some kind of noise sources might cause this frequency here to go up and down a little bit. And when it goes up and down, you accumulate some phase error, and then you get a dephasing. That's essentially given by the noise at near zero frequencies or low frequencies of this. So it's a very simple picture. Now, when you go to a bosonic bath, to a fermionic bath, things get really interesting. And there's lots of neat physics here. This is a nonlinear response. So now this dissipation source, because this is nonlinear, depends on temperature and power, and in fact decreases with increasing temperature and power in a way that a lot of times makes you think that there's no dissipation from two-level states, when in fact it's a big problem. It kind of hides this problem. You get non-exponential coherence effects. You get things like amplitude decoherence coming from coupling to high frequency mode. Very strange things here. There's even a fluctuation dissipation type theorem for this 1 over F noise, which is your low frequency noise, which relates this noise to high frequency dissipation. A lot of this is universal for amorphous materials, but also depends on some physics that is interesting. So there's a lot of things to think about, and I'll try to talk about that today. Probably the most important thing, though, is that our recent results, experimental results, seems to indicate, at least for our qubit, that this is a fixable problem. It's hard. You have to figure out what's going on. But once you figure out what's going on, you know how to fix it. And I can show this with recent improvements in the phase qubit. So to kind of review the physics so that we can understand this, I'm going to first talk about our phase qubits and so show some recent results where we have really good coherence and been doing some very good, almost algorithm kind of things, show you that the phase qubit is good, and then once we're motivated by, okay, we can fix the problem and make it better, I'll go back and talk about the two-level state physics and show you kind of how that works. So let's talk about superconducting qubits. The basic idea behind the superconducting qubits is very simple. We're just making a nonlinear LC inductor capacitor resonator. The inductor is coming from the superconducting Josephson junction. The capacitance is from the self-capacitance of the junction. It's easy to see the nonlinearity. You just write down the Josephson relations, differentiate this, combine this, you get IJ is proportional to V. It's equation of motion for an inductor, where now this Josephson inductance goes as 1 over cosine delta, where delta is the phase superconducting phase difference across here. This cosine delta makes it nonlinear. And as you see, as I goes to I0, the bias current goes to the critical current, delta goes to the power of 2, that goes to 0, it kind of blows up. Now, if you had a linear LC resonator, you could write the potential and the inductor as a parabola. Of course, you can't make a qubit out of that, but the nonlinearity of this, it turns out for the phase qubit, that linear potential, quadratic potential, turns into a qubit potential. The qubit potential in the system can be controlled by the bias current I, where that both changes the potential barrier height here and the oscillation frequency at the bottom of the well. So this is sort of a classical description right here. You quantize the problem, and then you have quantized energy levels. Wave functions look like a harmonic oscillator. Here are the energy levels. They're now split, so you can do qubit operations. They also have tunneling through this well, so these states, if you bias it right, can come down here and then have some self-amplification. And we use this tunneling phenomenon for measurement. Also, it's basic quantum mechanics. You might want to put in decoherence. Say one way to do that simply is just say you put a resistor across here. For that particular model of decoherence, you get a lifetime that goes 1 over RC, kind of what you expect because these are nearly harmonic oscillator states. So with that basic physics, you know how to make a qubit. You basically start your system in this well. You let it decay to the ground state by letting it sit there for a long enough time. You then can do qubit operations by putting in a bias current, a DC bias current, and also some currents that are resonant with the 1-0 transition. Here's a Bloch sphere representation of the state in terms of the tipping angle and the phase angle. A low-frequency DC current changes the oscillation frequency of the qubit, and that corresponds to Z rotations, where you just change the phase of the qubit. And then if you put on microwaves resonant with the qubit, that corresponds to rotations along one of these X or Y axes, this being coming from a sine of omega T, and if you change the microwaves by 90 degrees, you can rotate it around this axis. So basically, by your bias current, you can do a full qubit manipulation however you want. And then finally, you want to do state measurement. And that, what you do is you just take this DC bias current and you make it a large pulse of current that shrinks this delta U down to a small value. And then if you arrange things right, you'll have the one state that tunnels out from here. So that's the measurement given this amplification process here. If it's a zero state, it won't tunneling. So here's the probability of tunneling versus pulse height. We want to be where this pink arrow is so that the zero state doesn't tunnel and the one state tunnels, and then we can measure the state with high fidelity. So we make this circuit, standard IC fabrication, optical lithography, nothing very fancy. Here's our qubit right here, it's the Josephson junction. We put it in a loop here. We put current through this gradiometer here, and that biases up current in this loop going through the qubit. Then we can change the qubit bias by putting a small pulse of current here. That's a Z rotation. We could put microwaves through this capacitor here, and that gives us excitations to do XY rotations. And then when we want to measure it, or this thing self-measures, when it measures, you get a flux quantum change through here, and that's easily measured with this readout squid. This is put in the dilution refrigerator, 20 millikelvin. We have bias lines connected to a computer. The interesting part here is we have this microwave generator and an IQ modulator that gives us pulses of microwaves of arbitrary amplitude and phase coming into here. and then we can put on these pulses here for the Z rotations and measurement through this line here. The typical experiment goes like this. We, through one of these other lines, we put a change in the bias current, which resets the qubit in this qubit potential well. Then at this point, we do our computation by putting in, say, microwave X pulses, Y pulses, Z pulses through this line, do whatever experiment we're going to do. Then we put a big pulse here to measure the state. If it's in the one state, you then tunnel out, and we can then measure that with that squid device. And when we ramp up the squid, if it was in the zero state, we get a measuring of a voltage across the squid at one value current. And if it's the one state of the squid, it's another value. These are very well separated, so for each experiment, we know it's zero or one. We then repeat that 1,000 times to get a probability of those two states. So, okay, let's start looking at some data. This is a manufactured qubit, so we need to know where the energy level transitions are. We do that through spectroscopy. So we take our microwave current, microwave, and we put in a long pulse to saturate the transition, and then we do a measurement pulse and say, okay, are we in the one state? This here is actually a plot in grayscale of the probability to be in the one state. And most of the time, you're off resonance and nothing happens. And then when you sit on this line right here, you then have the microwave frequency is equal to transition frequency. You populate the one state, and then you get this enhancement here. And this kind of makes sense. You see here at low current biases, you have a big delta U, a steep potential. And then as you increase the bias current to here, this goes down, this flattens out, and the frequency goes down. So from this plot, we get the transition frequency as a function of I, nice smooth curve as we expect. Note that there's these little avoided two-level crossings here, here, and here. There's not too many. That's good. Note that in previous versions of our qubit, I mean, these were terrible. Lots of them, big resonances, conventional design. This is where we had lots of problems. This whole talk is about once we understood that, we fixed it, we got this, everything's great. So these are the kind of experiments you do on a single qubit to see if it's working. You do a Rabi oscillation where you put on a pulse of microwaves and then you measure in your one state. You start off in the ground state. When you do a Rabi, you start moving the block vector down into the one state, which is what you measure going from here to here. And then you continue putting on microwaves. You then go back to the zero state and oscillate between the zero and one state as a function of time that the microwaves are on. And you see nice oscillations have high amplitude and just look really good. You can do more complicated, say Ramsey, where you tip at 90 degrees. You see if there's some phase noise on it. Then you kind of tip it again in measurement. And again, you get nice big oscillations with some decay here. You can do echo to try to remove some of the decrease in T1 that you see here. You can do T1 experiments. From all this, you can basically characterize your qubits, get the T1 and T5. These numbers are long enough so that you can do enough operations to start doing some simple experiments with this. The big thing that's really nice about this is this very large visibility of the system. This is the probability in the one state. This is our raw output data. It's not corrected in any way. And having large visibility here really means for us that the qubit is working well. There's not all this dirt physics messing us up. By having this large visibility, we can start doing some complex experiments. So let me talk a little bit about what we've been able to do in the last 6 months or so. The first one being state tomography. And state tomography is very important because you do some operation and you want to say, well, what's the final state of your quantum system? You want to measure that accurately, and then you can backtrack whether everything was working properly. To do state tomography, you basically want to measure the state of the system in the z-axis, in the x-axis, and in the y-axis. Now, for photons, you just rotate your polarizer. We can't do that here. So to z-axis is easy, but to measure in the y-axis, what we do is we take our qubit state and just rotate it 90 degrees around our x-axis, and that's equivalent to measuring in the basis of the in the y-basis. And similarly, for the X basis, you just rotate around Y with the microwave pulse. So this is the experiment. We put in a microwave pulse, we create the 0 plus 1 state, then we put in a Z state so that this state is going to rotate around in the rotating frame, and then at some point we do state tomography. So we either do no microwave pulse that measures in the Z, we put in an X that measures in the Y, we put in the Y pulse 90 degrees that measures in the X basis, and then we get a probability versus time for these three cases. And then you just put it into the standard formulation of state tomography, and you can get how your block vector is changing in time, which is plotted here. It starts out at the 0 plus 1 state over here, and then because of this tuning, it's oscillating around in time. And then you see that it's decohering, it's relaxing to the 0 state, and also getting smaller in here because of dephasing. And basically, you know, this very detailed behavior here agrees exactly what we expect from the dephasing in T1 times that we saw in the last slide. Excuse me? T1 was 110 and dephasing was 80, 85. Well, you have to, yeah, you can't directly see dephasing. If you were to do a Ramsey, you could see that. But T1 and dephasing causes this to spiral in a different way. There's no spin echo going on here. Okay. Now that we understand how to do tomography, you can start doing some interesting experiments and testing in more detail how our qubit is operating. This is an experiment that was suggested by collaborator Sasha Korotkov to look at state evolution from partial measurement. So let me explain why this is kind of an interesting experiment. The postulates or quantum mechanics is that, one, you have wave-like evolution of the state of your system, unitary linear evolution due to the Schrödinger equation. And then two, you have particle-like non-unitary state protection operations. And of course, it's this particle-like projections is how you use what you're going to use for error correction. Okay? Well, what's interesting about partial measurement is you're able to do an experiment where you can sort of tune between either a wave-like time evolution and a particle-like. It's not either. You can have part of one and part of the other. It's kind of like a turning a knob between these two. And when you do that and you look at the state evolution, you see coherent evolution but non-unitary evolution with some kind of collapse due to the particle-like behavior too. And this is kind of interesting, kind of look inside measurement and see if your system is working right. So let me be specific how we do that. What should we do is we start in the ground state, we put in a microwave pulse, and we create a superposition of a 0 plus 1 state. And then we do a measurement of the state. But now we make our pulse height not as high as we talked about before, so that there's a probability P less than 1 that if you're in the 1 state, you'll tunnel out. Okay, so since you're equal probability of 0 and 1, if you're in one state, you have a probability of P over 2 that it'll tunnel out. And we can measure that. So we measure that right here. That's this channel. Now, there's a probability of 1 minus P over 2 that it doesn't tunnel. And if you look at POVM theory, that means the final state, now the 1 state here is decreased by the factor 1 minus P. And then there's a new normalization factor here. For the wavefront. So what that happens is, it means in this case here, these probabilities, you start with 0 plus 1, and then the state rotates from here into the 0 state as P goes from 0 to 1. Note that this is a non-unitary evolution of this state vector. So what do? We do the first experiment, measure this. We then do in the second experiment, we do a tomography pulse here, then measure, do a full height probability measurement, and then determine via tomography what this state looks like. Okay? So this is the data. This is the tipping angle here versus partial measurement probability here. In the blue, we started out at 90 degrees, and then if there's probability of measuring at zero, of course it stays 90 degrees, and then as the partial probability goes up to one, this number drops here, and these are the experiment and the dots, and the theoretical prediction that I described earlier is this straight line, this blue line here, excuse me. We start a little bit higher than 90 degrees, it comes down again in the expected way. So we really have a good confirmation that this is evolving in the way that it's supposed to. Also note in this experiment that there's an angle around here we want to measure. And we put this current pulse, we're also changing the oscillation frequency, so we're going to pick up phase in this this state of the system. The phase is measured here, and it goes down according to what we expect. Note that between these two cases of the blue and the red, which have different tipping angles, the phase accumulation is the same, you know, as you expect for a quantum state. Finally, you might want to ask, well, what's the coherence of this wave vector or the length of this vector, of the quantum state vector? This is that data plotted, normalized to what you expect from the theory. We see about 70 or 80% what we expect. When you plug in the various T1s, T2s in it, these are the predictions. Again, fairly good agreement between experiment and theory. Things work right. The Bloch equations, yes, and then this takes into account the decoherence from the T1, T2. Yeah. Okay. Now let's go on to coupled qubits. Take two qubits, put a capacitor between them. We get an interaction that interacts to 0, 1, and 1, 0 states. So the energy level diagram is here where we biased up the qubits. These are at the same energy levels. This splitting gives us new states, symmetric and antisymmetric, which are the eigenstates of the system. What we do in the experiment is we start in the ground state. We put a quick pi pulse on one of the qubits to go into the 1-0 state, and then this state here starts to oscillate between the 1-0 and 0-1 state. If we have this oscillation go on for 16 nanoseconds, that's about a quarter of the S, you then are in the state 1-0 minus I-0-1. It's an entangled state. Then what you do is you do state tomography, 9 experiments, doing this rotations and measurements on the 2-qubit states. So when you get all that data, you can then infer what your tomography, you can do tomography, infer what the density matrix of the state is. And here I plot the real part of the density matrix, imaginary part here. You see on the real part, you see mostly 1-0 and 0-1 states. And that's, of course, as you expected, because you're creating the equal amplitude of 1-0 and 0-1. Of course, you look at the diagonals to see the coherence. This is very small here, as you expect. In the imaginary component, you see that this height is roughly equal to the height here, showing you, indeed, you have a nice coherent state. You can work out the fidelity. It's pretty good. This I-swap gate here is, in fact, a universal gate, so we expect we should be able to do more complicated CNOT gates or other kind of computations once we do more experiments in the future. So that's basically the data that I have, quick overview of what we've done to show you that our system is now working very well. And now I want to tell you the story of how we got there and what we fixed to make this qubit well. And this story starts with a very simple experiment. This experiment is so simple, it took us 5 years to do it. Because, you know, why would we get any information from this? But it's extremely interesting. What we do is we just make an LC resonator. As you studied in undergraduate elementary physics class, we bring microwaves in, resonate this up, measure the voltage across this resonator with a microwave amplifier, and just measure the power out here versus frequency as we tune through this at various values of Pn. And what we get is this, a nice Lorentzian curve, full width half backs. You can get the Q of the system, which tells you the loss. And in this particular model, this is going to tell us where the damping is mostly from the capacitor, tells us the loss tangent, the loss of this capacitor, given by this relationship here. Now, what's interesting here, and totally surprising to us, is as you lower the power, you see that this resonance here gets wider and wider and wider. And in fact, if you plot this loss tangent versus amplitude of the microwaves across this LC resonance, you see at high powers and high temperatures, hey, this looks like a pretty good insulator, perfectly fine. Yet you go to low powers, low temperatures, you see that the loss here is almost 1%. It's a horrible, horrible insulator. And of course, when you operate your qubit, you're in the low power, low temperature regime. This is the number that corresponds to qubits. It's bad. It's totally unexpected. Excuse me? We haven't done a real systematic check of that, but if you do qubits at different frequencies, slightly different frequencies, it's the same. I mean, this is it's a render about 6 gigahertz. We always do that because that's where we're making our qubit. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, of course you. Excuse me. Oh, we haven't done that yet. So that's something we want to do. Yes, it's a good question. So what's going on here? Well, you look back in the literature. This isn't even in the Russian literature. We kind of felt embarrassed. 1977. All this has been understood and looked at previously. Basically, we have an amorphous insulator, and you have random bonding on the atoms. And there are atoms. Most of the atoms are in a nice stable position. But one atom in 10 to the 7 or so, it has two equilibrium positions that it likes to sit at. And then if the tunneling matrix element is right, those two spots will resonate back and forth at this microwave frequency that you're looking at here. And then you're able to take energy from this and pump it into this two-level state system like this. And then it decays via phonons. Now, what happens here is if you go to high power or temperature, you start saturating this transition so that you're equally likely to put energy in as you are take energy out of this system. And that's why the high power results, you don't see any dissipation. And of course, at low temperature, low power, you're in the ground state and you can only absorb energy and then things look bad. So it really explains this. It's quite simple, and it shows that you really have to worry about two-level states and that the nonlinearity of the two-level states is incredibly important. So that's looking at this kind of loss in a bulk material. But you can also see this same loss in your tunnel junctions. And let's go back to the spectroscopy measurement I showed earlier. Microwave frequency versus qubit bias. This should be a nice straight line. And then what we have is we have all these avoided two-level crossings here. This is for a small area junction. This is for a larger area junction. Splittings are smaller, but you have more. What I plotted here is the number of splittings integrated from some low value, some splitting size S prime. So it's integrated number of splittings versus log of the splitting sizes. And you see what you kind of see here. There's, in this case, a linear with a log scale distribution. And then at some maximum splitting size, you don't see any splittings anymore. So what's going on here? Well, this is just this two-level state. You have an electric dipole oscillating between these two states. And this is when the qubit resonates with this particular two-level state system, you then get a splitting of the system. Now, you can go through and you can calculate what's going on here. You standard two-level state theory. You can calculate the density of these states. You basically, when you do that calculation, you get a 1 over splitting side distribution, which matches this. You get a cutoff at S-max, which matches this feature. You plug in S-max is proportional to the dipole moment size. This explains the sharp cutoff. You calculate from this S-max these measured parameters. You get a dipole moment size of 0.13 nanometers. It's the size of an atom. And in fact, if you look in the literature, that's basically the size of the OH bond and exactly what you expect from the literature of what's going on. So all we're seeing here is we're seeing the qubit resonating with these big dipoles. And there's a cutoff is because there's a maximum dipole size having to do with this aligned in this direction with dipole moment size of D. So everything explains these charge fluctuators at 10 gigahertz really explain the resonances. No, you have to operate this, the qubit, in the zero voltage state, so you can't do that. These are essentially zero voltage across here. You just can't do that. Yeah, but I can't put a voltage from here to here. This is my qubit. That there's other dipoles you'll pull right in. I mean, it's the way the distribution works. Yeah, you can move this, but I don't know how to put a voltage across the device. Okay. Now what we want to do is we want to say, okay, let's talk about qubit physics. You're going to bias at some point here, and what do all these two-level state resonators, how does that affect the coherence of the qubit? Okay, so they're very easy story here. We have our qubit, it has some energy levels, 0 and 1, and then you have all these junction resonances that are at different energies, and there's a different amount of coupling between each of these resonances to the junction, which I represent as sort of the width of this line. And then you have to figure out, well, how does all these junction resonances affect my qubit? To understand this, it's very convenient to talk about kind of two limits. One limit, and these two limits are delineated by the number of resonances coupled to the qubit. So is this a dense set of resonances or is it a sparse set? So you can work out some coupling number by saying, okay, I'm going to count it if it's within S of energy within this, and you can find that this coupling number scales at the square root of A over about 100 microns squared. Basically says if you go to small area junctions, you can kind of statistically avoid this. But let's take the limit here, NC is greater than 1. You can use Fermi-Golden rule to produce the decay of this qubit state coupled to about the two-level states. And you get basically a linear decay that basically tells you that there's a loss tangent associated with all these two-level state resonators. And you work out that loss tangent from the 10 nanoseconds. You measure from such a sample, and that gives you 1.6 times 10 to minus 3, very, very similar to SiO2. Okay? So these amorphous materials with lots of OH or defects in it give you these kind of loss tangents. Makes perfect sense. What we're interested in is what happens when NC is much large, so we can make a good qubit. So what we do is we have a Monte Carlo simulation where we do a pi pulse, excite the one state, then watch it decay due to coupling to all these two-level states. When the NC is very large, big area junctions, nice exponential decay as you expect, you start making NC near 1, you get the exponential decay, but it kind of bounces up and down because the energy that you're going from the qubit to your two-level state is coming back. What's interesting is for smaller area junctions, NC is about a half. The behavior is very much dependent on how close to a resonance you are. If you're close to a resonance, you basically slosh the state back and forth between that resonance, and you get something like this. But if you operate far away from a resonance, then you have a nice, you don't get any oscillation and everything's good. Although note that you still have some depression of the amplitude of your state due to off-resonant coupling to these states. And I call this a depression of coherence amplitude. So basically, we need this coupling number, area very small, to statistically avoid resonances. This is great. You observe a decrease in coherence amplitude. But if you make NC small enough, then you're OK. And we can do that in the Josephson qubits. OK, now that's qubit coherence. Let's now talk about state measurement. What happens in state measurement, we put a current through our junction, and the plasma frequency, the oscillation frequency, then lowers. Okay, when it lowers, it means that it's going to sweep through a bunch of other resonances here. And when you sweep those resonances, the number of resonances you're going to couple to goes up by several orders of magnitude, 2-3 orders of magnitude, which basically means you're in this limit where you're coupling to a lot of resonances most of the time, okay? You compute in that limit. You can think of do this computation with Landau-Zener tunneling formulas. Basically, if you go slow, you adiabatically transfer the state probability to these things, and you lose your state probability. But in this limit here, you can compute it, and you get this very simple result that the probability to remain in the one state is exponential, a minus gamma 1, which was this 10 nanosecond, times the pulse time. And basically, it says you have some kind of normal loss of the coherence of this into these states. You need to pulse it very fast in order to not lose fidelity in the measurement, and basically explains why we lose fidelity loss in the measurements. Okay? You want to pulse fast. Okay, so now I've been talking now about the high effect of these two-level states for the high at high frequency, okay, and how that affects the qubit measurement alike. Now let me switch gears a tiny bit, and let's talk about how these two-level states affect low-frequency charge. And what happens is, to see that, let's consider the experiments that were done here. This is a single electron tunneling resistor, a transistor, and then you bias this up so that the current through this device here is dependent on the charge through this. And because of 1 over F charge fluctuations, that current fluctuates in time, and you can represent that as effective charge noise, and you see that this is a 1 over F spectrum. The lower the frequency you go, the higher the charge squared noise is, okay? Experimentally, we have this kind of typical number here, scales as area, as you expect. Now, what we've measured so far is dissipation at 10 gigahertz, and I want to compare what's going on with 10 gigahertz with 1 hertz. When you do this experiment, every once in a while you bring into here a discrete two-level fluctuator where you see the charge here oscillating up and down by a magnitude something like E over 10 or E over 20. So this is a charge kind of popping, moving around in your barrier, causing this to affect the charge here to vary by this much. This number makes sense. Remember back here we talked about S max cutoff, and we got a dipole moment size D of 1 atom. Well, 1 atom, 0.13 nanometers, is about 1/10 the distance from here and here. And when you have a two-level state that's fluctuating by 10% of the distance, it means E over 10 charge bias is getting induced to these two leads here. This E over 10 is exactly what you see over here. So the magnitude of these fluctuations makes sense at 1 hertz and 10 gigahertz. It's the same fluctuators. Of course it's the same. The other thing to notice is, remember in this particular discussion here, the splitting distribution wins 1 over the size. Here this goes as 1 over frequency. You basically have the same dependence. And this comes out of the two-level state model. Perhaps even more interesting is, with this model, I can take this physics and predict the magnitude of this 1 over F noise here. This is taking sort of standard two-level state model, or maybe the Schneerman et al. Theory, constant density of states for two-level states, and you get a prediction of the charge density, charge noise, that's given by KT over the capacitance, 1 over F, but it's proportional to the loss tangent of this material at high frequency. It's a fluctuation dissipation theorem that's relating the fluctuations at 1 hertz to the dissipation at gigahertz frequencies. You plug in 1.6 times 10 to the minus 3, crank 10 to the minus 5. It's with an order of magnitude of what you get here. That's very good agreement for 1 over F noise. And in fact, there's lots of ways to get these numbers to agree by correcting these things in various ways. So we have, at this point, some kind of... let me say one more thing. We talk a lot about this large charge noise being a problem for these small area qubits. Hey, to reduce this charge noise, what this tells you is all you have to do is make a dielectric with that's less lossy at 10 gigahertz. Okay, we know what to do. So we don't have to fix anything at 1 hertz. We have to fix something at 10 gigahertz. Okay, that's what's really nice. We know what to do now. There's a cutoff frequency, and then it goes down to arbitrary low frequency because you put in certain assumptions in your two-level state model. Usually 10^-3, 100, 1,000 hertz. You see, it changes a little bit. Well, okay, there's some details in the two-level state model that aren't in there. So let me explain how we took this knowledge and improved our qubit. This is the first generation qubits, low amplitude, low times. The problem here was we had our junction, but we had some extra wiring in the device with very bad dielectrics, giving us a lot of loss. So we just replaced this dielectric with a better dielectric. Here we got T1 500 nanoseconds, way better, okay? Our amplitude here is still 60%, not what we want, and this was due to these two-level state fluctuators in the junction itself. To get rid of those or minimize those, what we did is we made the junction area smaller, about 10, 30 times smaller, and then to keep the capacitance the same, we added the shunting capacitor so that the frequencies and the size of the resonances were the same. And then we got this 90% good fidelity oscillations. Note here that the T1 is 100 nanoseconds. It's less than this, but this is exactly what we expected because we knew that the silicon nitride was not the best dielectric in the world. And for the fourth generation, all we're trying to do is replace the silicon nitride with a less lossy material, which we think we can do, but okay, we have to do that. But by changing this two-level state, number of two-level states, we got much better behavior. So let me review what I've described so far. This two-level state dielectric loss really explains all of what we think is all of the dirt physics, at least in our qubit, but maybe in all the other Josephson qubits. And this is really interesting. You're basically making an LC resonator. The superconductivity part of this circuit, which includes this amazing nonlinearity to give us the qubit states, because that's a gap in the superconductor, this is good, no loss. It's this linear capacitor that's all the problem. This loss in the capacitor hidden from classical measurements, you have to be careful, prove crossover dielectrics, small area junctions can statistically avoid this loss. That's why the small area qubits work well. You get amplitude decoherence, you can get measurement fidelity loss very easily from this, even if you use small junctions. And this is the source of 1/F charge noise, we believe. Now let me talk about the future now. What we're doing here is using kind of off-the-shelf dielectrics. And this is not optimized at all. Right now, I kind of consider we're in the germanium transistor era, okay? We've just invented these things. We're using the best materials we have right now. And germanium was better in silicon. It's a better semiconductor. But what happened once they understood the physics, they started going to this poorer or harder semiconductor material because the insulator of SiO2 was better. And it's kind of like here. Note, it's not the superconductivity we're worried about. It's the capacitor. It's the dielectric. And our hope is with the new materials, finding this super insulator, we have the superconductor, finding a super insulator, we can make much better. So what do we do? What's very nice is all we're focusing on now, we know what to improve. We have to improve the loss tangent, this intrinsic loss tangent. And I can go through, we have a lot of clues on what to do here. Here's all our data, amorphous data. We have some better materials. But the bottom line I want you to take home is that, first of all, the present materials we're using here are really horrible. They're very, very bad materials. And we know that if you go to crystals, the loss tangent of this is well below this number. We actually don't really have good measurements yet. But we can improve this by orders of magnitude just by going from amorphous to crystalline. And that's basically what we're trying to learn how to do. This is hard. We know a solution exists. It's just a matter of putting it in the right structure to make our qubit. And that technology we're working on. Okay, so that's kind of the end of the story. Very much want to acknowledge our team here at the UC Santa Barbara, collaborators. Some of this work is done at NIST. It's only with a lot of hard work were we able to figure out these very practical problems, and this was really a team effort. And then to conclude, let me say that these Josephson phase cubists work, Josephson cubists work well even with these bad materials. However, now that we understand what's going on, we have a very big potential for large improvement, orders of magnitude improvement, doing simple things with the materials. Very optimistic we can go to 3 to 4 qubits given how well things are working, and given some more improvements here, maybe even larger. Look, understanding the two-level state physics was key to everything we did, and you know, we're on the road to making things better. I would very much like to talk to other people about other experiments, because maybe what we learned here can help all the qubit implementations. So thank you very much. When we started realizing this a little time, a while ago, we started investigating that, and funding agents were very nice to provide some funds to get an MBE system. So I have an MBE system in the lab, and we're trying right now to grow metal insulators with MBE techniques. So that's what we're doing right now, and we're trying to figure that out right now. And we'll see. This is a very hard problem. There's not that much literature, especially looking in the way we're looking at it. But, you know, we're optimistic that we can do things.
Yeah, John, considering the fact that you're talking geared toward people hearing, why did you couch it primarily in Q1
and not a little about Q2? Let's see. For our qubit, we are not sensitive to charge fluctuations, so we're just sensitive to the T1 effects. And then for the other qubits, yes, this is going to affect T2. So it's kind of because that's where we have all our data. But what's nice is we can begin to relate the two. And we think by improving the junction dielectrics, we can lower the charge noise, we can probably even lower the critical current noise significantly to help the other qubits and make all of this better. I mean, you still may need the degeneracy point, but that's going to be a lot easier to use. And maybe you can move off of it a little bit.
Also, can you reapply your comment about 75% developing these pretty good? That's probably pretty good relative to what has been done previously.
Okay, so our best fidelities now are 85, 90%. And we were about 40%, 50% for a long time. And the remaining of that, most of that is due to just simple T1 effects. So as soon as we replace our silicon nitride capacitor with a better one, I think we're going to be at the probably 95% level, and then we're started to limit by other physics. What I would say is, when we look at our data carefully, all of the things we don't understand seem to be related to this two-level state problem. We don't see other big problems coming in. So we want to improve that and then figure out kind of what the next level of things we have to fix. And you know, we'll see when we get there. Yes, yes. Could be the case. There could be more complicated physics going on here. Oh, come on, where are you? Let me talk about that. Where are we here? Is that here? Here. Is that here? No, here. Okay. Okay. This dependence, KT, it basically comes from the fact that you say that the number of two-level states per frequency is constant. The dielectric loss is constant. And you basically see that the number of states, which is the area within KT between zero, this is the number of states you thermally excite, goes as KT, and that's what KT there. If you have a linear dependence of delta I versus frequency, then that area under that will be KT squared, and that will do that. It's interesting, note, if you do have that linear dependence on delta I, the prediction here then lowers, and it kind of comes close to here. So that's kind of an experiment we need to do, is for some of these materials, we have to see whether that's a linear or a constant. But of course, that may be for silicon dioxide versus aluminum oxide in the tunnel junction. Maybe different materials have different density of states. We have to work this out. We have to take the data. Okay, that is for phonon, that's two-level states affecting the phonons. When you look at the electrical data, it is not universal in that way. I think there's some universality. Instead of being hundreds of papers, there are about five papers out there. And it's not universal, which is why no one studied it. So I think it's quite possible. I mean, I don't know yet. It could be something else. But I think it's quite possible that we have a different kind of behaviors here, and that the system is not universal and complex, and that the different results from different groups are because they're growing different amorphous materials. So, yeah, we will find out.
You said you were optimistic about the 4 to 10 qubit computer. Why is 10 the number which you run out of optimism?
Because I want to be kind to my graduate students. We're trying to build our qubit experiment so that it's scalable to some degree. And if things go well with the chip design and various microwave issues and the like, we think with the dilution refrigerator we own right now and are using, we could put in 40 to 60 qubits and scale up, just brute force scale up to that level. But I don't want to start talking about that too seriously until we start understanding all the physics at a small number. But our plan, optimistic plan, but it's real, reliable, and we're building hardware to do that, is just to try to brute force scale up so that we have, you know, 50 mixers and microwave components and room temperature, a few hundred coax going down, just doing that. And we're hoping at that level there's a lot of interesting science to do. You know, and then scaling on longer, that's a little bit more industrial scale in figuring out how to do the control. But, okay, you know, let's take one step at a time. So I would like to say, if people are interested in visiting the lab and seeing this refrigerator and kind of how we do that, I'm busy tonight, but if you want to see me tomorrow, we can go over to Broida and take a look at the lab. I'd be happy to show people around. So thank you.